Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Jonathan Brown, author of A Boxing Trainer's Journey, a novel based on the life of Angelo Dundee. This Italian-American from South Philly trained and served as a cornerman to 15 world boxing champions, including Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard. He also trained Russell Crowe for his performance as a boxer in Cinderella Man. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yay. I'm going to start with the question I always ask, because I think it's really important to readers to know, why does Dundee matter to us today?
Okay. Can I start by saying why he mattered to me first?
I think that's wonderful.
Okay. All right. So I don't know if your listeners know this, but I am black. And when I was coming up in the 70s, the heroes to myself and my siblings was Muhammad Ali.
Exactly.
And I used to get Ring magazine. And when other kids were staring at comic books, I would look at Ring magazine and see all these muscled up brothers. And I would read the articles and I would read that the trainer was Angelo Dundee. So Muhammad Ali was a role model and he was a superhero when I was really small.
And he still is.
Yeah, exactly. See, I was right at such a young age of five or whatever. But so that's why he and Angelo were important to me. He's important to us. Not just because he was the guy behind the guy, meaning Muhammad Ali, but the sport of boxing, older people older than myself would say the era of Joe Louis and those fighters was the greatest era. And some would say it was Ali Frazier and that time. But Dundee was a guy in a brutal business, a corrupt business, a bloody business that was just a straight shooter and was incorruptible. You could apply some of the things that he said yesterday to today. He was and is an inspiration. That's why I think he's important.
I think I agree with that. First of all, we need inspirations for children today. And This is a sport that people don't necessarily understand completely. Mm-hmm. So Getting more involved in why it meant so much to him and how this relationship was between him and Muhammad Ali, I think is really interesting, because there is a relationship between the Italian-American community and the African-American community. And it comes and goes. Sometimes it's a good relationship and sometimes there are issues. So I can imagine with them in the middle of the civil rights movement, how fascinating that was.
That's so fascinating, and I'll get back to that point. I'm trying to keep that tradition going because my wife is Italian.
Well, that's wonderful.
And I could not have married into a better family. I love my in-laws. So, yeah, with the civil rights stuff going on, when Ali changed his name to Muhammad Ali from Cassius Clay, he hadn't even told Angelo that. Angelo found out at the press conference when everybody else did.
Wow.
And still, he stuck by Ali, and he looked at it from his early upbringing. His parents drilled into him that you are no better or worse than anybody else, and we're all the same. And that was non-negotiable, and it was plain and simple. And the press came after. They tried to have gotcha moments, so to speak, with Angelo, and Angelo just said, even though he was blindsided by the switch to the Nation of Islam and all that stuff, he said, Ali deserves to fight. And, you know, I'll train anybody. I will train a Martian as long as they have a good left hook, you know. Yeah, he just didn't. He was such a purist of the sport. And he just thought it had no place for racism did not have a place. And he just like, this is injustice. And when Ali was exiled for about 4 years for, you know, going to Vietnam, Dundee spoke out for him and said that it was wrong. So that's speaking out against the man in the 60s, which could be a scary thing to do.
Exactly. And an admirable thing to do. And again, it does speak to that relationship and that trust the two of them had.
Yes.
That's
absolutely
so fascinating. So my question is going to be, how do you think Angelo's childhood influenced this attitude that he had? Because it isn't necessarily the norm of that day.
Again, I think he had such a solid foundation from his parents that they just, there was faith there too, and we're all God's children and created equally. So it wasn't even a thought in Angelo or his siblings' mind that any race should be treated greater or lesser than the other. And then from there, he became just fascinated with boxing. And he would train the best fighters, and he trained the Italians, Willy Pisciano and those cats coming up, and then Ali and some black fighters. And when Cuba was still open, he went over to Cuba and trained a bunch of Cuban fighters, and he was one of the first guys to do that. So he, as the cliche goes, he really did not see color. He just saw boxing.
Well, they say that when we have a passion for something, we get over those other attitudes that are really not of any value to the world because you're interested in the passion.
Yes.
Great. Now, were his parents, were they immigrants?
Yes.
So what other relationships in his life do you think fueled him? He's got the friendship with Muhammad Ali and a couple of other boxers. And then did he have, obviously, his wife, other friends who were in the business? What relationships really got him going?
He had a really strong, and I think a beautiful relationship with his wife. Prior to that, there was one other woman before he went off to England, you know, to fight in the war. And then the relationship didn't survive that. And then he came back and met who would become his wife. So again, he wasn't a guy that was out there sowing oats and playing the field. He was a guy looking for love, and when he found it, he married one woman, and that was it. So that was a strong relationship. Also, with Muhammad Ali and the later, mid to later years, it changed from just trainer and fighter to father and son, and he often said that he always considered Muhammad like a son to him.
That's beautiful. So obviously the age range difference was in that realm too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Very much. All right. You know, you give me visions of Burgess Meredith and Sylvester Stallone because that's my...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Rocky was so broken up when his trainer died, if you remember.
Exactly. No, that's an understandable relationship. You train someone and you see them succeed, and that is something that you can be proud of forever.
Yeah, and I will say, personally, I have a martial art background, and I would say by my third or fourth belt that I looked at my master as a father figure. And even though I had a close relationship with my father, the amount of trust when you're – I also played football too. So when you're doing something that's brutal, like boxing, martial arts, football, once you get in the ring – there's nobody but you and your opponent. You get on the field, there's a whole bunch of people in pads that want to take your head off. So prior to that moment when you hear that bell, you have to have at least one person who's an expert, quote, in your corner. So that bond is just massive. And obviously these relationships break up often, and it's not some. From the outside, I might think, oh, maybe they had a fallout over money or something. And it's often it's not that. It's just that that relationship didn't gel. There was not simpatico there.
Which makes sense. That's true in any romantic relationship as well.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, at home, he had the home fires burning with a great relationship and then kids. And then at the gym, he also grabbed Muhammad. They got together when Muhammad just came out of the Olympics. So he was an amateur. So he was there in the early years of building him up when Muhammad was used to fighting three-round fights. And then he's like, and Muhammad was so eager and so cocky and so mouthy from day one that he just wanted to go pro right away. And he had to be like a father figure to say, slow down, son, you will go pro, but not before we're ready, sort of thing. So right there, that relationship, that whole mentor, mentee, student, teacher, father, son is very, what's the word I'm looking for? It exists.
It is.
It's huge.
It's true. It's huge in your life if you can get that kind of connection with someone.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, so we hit slightly on the civil rights movement, but I'm always interested in what were the burning questions that a person had to deal with in their day. So between the civil rights movement and, of course, again, with Ali, we have to deal with the Vietnam War. What was Angelo's stand on both those things, and sort of how did he support them or support his opinion?
A lot of those opinions he liked to keep close to his vest, but I do believe he sided with that famous line of Muhammad's, which is, ain't no Viet Cong done nothing to me, or something like that. I can't remember what the phrase is. And I think that Angelo looked at that too. I think he saw the senselessness of war, having served. And then that one was, the press started to sort of shine the light on what was going wrong than the previous, like, World War II.
Correct. Right? Correct, exactly.
And now today we have too much, so we don't even know what to believe.
True. But as you say, he had his own personal experience with war, so he had something to draw on.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, and being a good Christian, I love thy neighbor, all that stuff. Yeah, Angelo was not big on American hegemony or dominance or anything like that.
My other question then would be, who qualified as his competitors? Who were the other trainers that people were vying to work with, or, you know, in some way who he was going up against with his own fighters?
There's Freddie Roach, Lou Duva. But one thing I did find is all of the outside noise of, well, this trainer is training that guy and he does this with his guy. Angelo just had his own way of doing things, but he was always learning. And he was a big guy, a big proponent of, never mind what the other guy's doing. And that, he would say that to his fighters. He would say, don't spend all your time just looking at tape. Or when people were trying to sneak looks at other guys' workouts, Angelo didn't believe in any of that. They all knew each other. He didn't talk much about the other trainers, but he definitely had good, friendly relationships with a lot of sports writers. He liked those guys.
Oh, that's fun. And that was the era when sports writers were like little gods in their world.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in the beginning, you know, the sports writers that a lot of them have, they're critics, right? So a lot of trainers didn't like them, but Angelo wanted so much boxing. And when he was not in the gym, he wanted to go to the bar in New York, where those guys hung out, and they would just talk shop off the record, hopefully off the record. So yeah, I didn't, in my research, I didn't catch a lot of what he felt or what he had to say about other trainers. He was also the kind of guy from that era of, if you don't have something nice to say, then don't say anything at all. So maybe whatever animosities or biases he had, he pretty much kept them to himself.
Ah, well, that's also something to admire in a person.
Oh, 100%. And I have to say, I was just going to add to that writing this book was the first time I've written a book of this nature. I tend to write crime fiction. And it was such a breath of fresh air. And I said to my wife, I said, if I ever write another book like this, which is sort of historical fiction, I sure hope it's a nice guy or a nice woman, because I'd have trouble if they weren't a nice person.
And that's true in most of these mentors books. I will say we find very interesting. I happened to write the book on Filippo Mazzei, who owned a plantation next door to Thomas Jefferson. And I thought, oh no, this is going to be a man who owns slaves. But it turned out he ran his plantation with Italian wine laborers, and he didn't engage in slavery. And in fact, wrote a little bit against it, but couldn't get his buddy Thomas to listen to him.
Okay, let's trade books. I need to read your book, and you can read mine. I like that.
That's very true. But you touched on an important thing when you talk about research. So one of my fun questions to me is, what was the funnest thing you found while researching his life, a little moment or a fact about him that you thought really was very interesting?
Well, I'd say the most fun platform for me was going on YouTube and watching old fights. And then looking up after 90 minutes and realized, oh, I've just been a spectator. I haven't been paying attention. One thing I thought was pretty cool is he gets called to war. He gets stationed in England, and he wants to do his part because he's a big fan. He's proud to be an American. He wants to do his part. And he winds up at one point sort of just looking after musicians. Not musicians. The munitions, sorry.
Oh, there you go. Two different things. And are musicians.
Right. So he was far enough behind the lines that at being Italian, he was not wild about the army food. So he made good relationships with the officers and people that could get ingredients. And he became really popular because he would get this sausage and that whatever, and he would make his Italian pasta and everything for all the troops, and they just loved him. So he ended up sort of becoming quite powerful because, you know, what they say about men and food, right?
Well, and that's a hilarious thing to know about someone. But it makes sense that not just his Italian background, but if you're working in sports, you know that you have to give people quality food so they can perform well.
Right. And so when he had his brush with getting to the front line, I think he was up in a helicopter, and they got close to enemy lines and they got shot at. And some, you know, the aircraft was riddled with bullets, and I think he nearly fell out. And he said, "That is enough for me. I love Uncle Sam, but I don't need to get anywhere near the line again."
So, well, he had his own business that he could do. Everyone has to contribute in some way.
That's right. Exactly.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, I love that he made his own food. That's so ridiculously adorable, and yet so makes him such a human.
And he found a way when he did that, because there was definitely a division of some of the black soldiers with the white soldiers. And it was primarily the white soldiers from the southern states.
Of course.
And Angelo would sort of stand up for the brothers. There's a excerpt I throw in the book about that. But how did he get them all together? Is he would make a meal and have them all sit at the same table.
And if you wanted to eat the food, you had to sit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and then you realize that, you know, prejudice is just ignorance. So whatever small talk goes around a table of a bunch of soldiers over really good food, you realize, oh, I actually have more in common with you than I thought I did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's so brilliant because, of course, that does tell us so much about him, because he could simply have only fed his own soldiers.
Exactly.
He didn't have to do that.
Exactly.
So it's sometimes people don't make statements, maybe they don't march, but they do something that tells us what they really believe.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, without preaching it, just sort of showing instead of telling. Yeah, absolutely.
That's beautiful. I'm very excited about that fact. It is a very good find, I would say.
Yes.
Okay, so you're also leading me up into another question, which is, being that this is a work of historic fiction, you did a lot of research, but then, of course, you had to fill in some gaps and conversations that we don't have, you know, dictation from.
Yeah.
So what scene do you think was your favorite one to write? What did you really enjoy creating?
Oh, boy, I don't even have to think about it. I set up a scene where Muhammad Ali went, or maybe he was still Cassius, I can't remember, but he went to the Dundees for dinner.
Uh-huh.
And Angelo's kids were young. And so I created the scene where Muhammad Ali sort of gets down on his knees and plays with the little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he teases him, because any footage you see of Ali and you read the stories, he was always teasing. And you can see him, he would tease Angelo a lot. So within that, while he's there at that dinner, he was also teasing Angelo that his beautiful wife had to be kidnapped, because why would she, you know, and all this stuff. And I got so into it that I, you know, would do almost my best impressions of his voice and Angelo's. And that was my favorite scene to write, because they did have some dinners together and stuff like that. But, you know, I completely manufactured the one that I wrote.
Of course. But just knowing that they did, obviously they were having a connection. You can't ignore someone's children if you're in their home.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, that's great.
And one thing that really made me feel good to this point was there was a gentleman that runs a fan page on Facebook for Angelo. And we found each other and corresponded. And I sent him a copy of the book. And he got back to me 2 days later. And he said, "I spent a lot of time with Angelo, especially in the last 3 years of his life."
Uh-huh.
And he said, "I don't know how you did it, but it was as if you were in the room with some of the dialogue you wrote between he and Ali."
That is the highest compliment you could ever get.
Highest compliment ever. And, you know, if only he worked at the New York Times. No, that you're right. That made my year when he said that. Because this was a guy that knew the guy.
Right. You know? One of the things I'm always interested in, from a writing standpoint, is what theme did you find running through Angelo's life? If you could say that he had a lesson he was teaching people, what do you think that was?
Kindness. Kindness and respect. because I have it from when he's a little boy, he's bullied, and he goes through, you know, he lived into his 80s. So if you think from boxing, he saw when these fighters had to box for a living and they were broke and they were being paid to throw fights and the mob was in there. And the FBI was even looking at Angelo for a minute, like, is he corrupt? Right. You know,
of course they would assume that.
Right. And then you have, like you said, you have the civil rights movement, then you have Vietnam, you have all these decades he went through, and he always treated people with respect, and he also demanded it, even, you know, because usually, especially in a sport like that, the nice guy, if they don't finish last, they're going to be bullied or, and, you know, he wasn't. And I believe he is respected, and he was respected by the fighters because of the way he treated the fighters. So when you have that in a community, those fighters will protect you.
Which is very smart all around.
Very smart all around. Yeah,
well, exactly. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. So because Mentoris is, of course, very interested in the art of mentoring other people, my second to the last question is going to be, who were his mentors?
He worked for his older brother, who was much older, because there's a, I cannot remember, let's say there's between 11 and 13 siblings. There's a lot.
Of course, back in the day.
Back in the day. And I know that when he was coming up, I don't even think he saw his older brother. His oldest brother, Chris, was already gone. And Chris was the one that gave him the leg up into the whole business. But he gave him very little. He said, look, I'm going to New York to promote boxing. You can come with me. I'll give you a desk, but you're on your own. So even though he had to make his own way, which is really almost an art that's sort of gone nowadays.
True.
But he had to make his own way, yet he learned a lot just by watching his brother and how his brother could navigate the different personalities in business. So he got a lot of business sense from his brother, and the relationship was strained at times. There was times his brother would go weeks without paying him and say, well, look, you want to go back home? Go back home. This is what it is. I don't have the money right now. You're here. It's called the Big Apple. No, go get a piece of it. And so there was tough love, but he learned a lot from his brother. And he also learned that, you know, there are no free lunches. There's no handouts, you know, all that stuff, that pulling up by your bootstraps sort of way to go. But yeah, the main mentor I would say was his older brother, but the foundation and the strong influence was from the both parents.
That's wonderful. That's a story of family and what we learn from family.
Yes, that was the word I was looking for, family. thank you.
All right, I'm going to inject another one before I get to the last question, because now you...
Oh, good. Yeah. I've got time. Let's do another 2 hours.
Well, this is... I mean, I'm having such a great time chatting. I really could. But you're making me wonder, as he was mentored then, who were the people that he may have mentored besides his boxers? Like, did he mentor other coaches, his own children?
Yes, his son... one of his sons got into the sport with him and started out just as a bucket boy like he did. And then they cornered some fights together. And I think he had another relationship that would have been similar to the friendship and relationship he had with Ali, and that was with Sugar Ray Leonard. Mm-hmm. However, right in the 80s, big money came into boxing through HBO and television.
Correct, of course, yes.
And then Sugar Ray had a real shark of a lawyer. Mm. And he really drove a wedge in between the two of them, because he was business. And, you know, so Angelo had got his pay deducted and all kind of thing like that. So I think that really tarnished another possible mentorship right there. But still, Angelo never complained to Sugar Ray. Sugar Ray never said anything about the business side. They just did the boxing thing. So I think to Angelo, he probably looked at that relationship more of a job because of that bad seed, which was the lawyer.
Well, and that happens, you know, that happens in many stories, is that person who's more interested in the money aspect of it than the personal and the connection.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the beautiful things, it's not really a mentorship, but another one of the great friendships that he had, is many years earlier, Ali beat George Foreman, and back when George Foreman was probably only 19 years old in that famous fight. And then years later, when Ali was done with the sport because of the Parkinson's and stuff, George Foreman made a comeback, and he approached Angelo. And George was, when he saw him plop down beside him in the airport, he's like, this is not going to go well, because that guy used to be the enemy, so to speak.
Right.
But by this time, George had gone through this big transformation through religion and soul searching, and he was no longer the heel or the villain anymore. He was just this lovable George teddy bear. and he said, I want to take a run for the title. I'm approaching 40, but I won't do it unless you train me. And he said, I'd love to. So, and I have a little part of it in the book. A lot of it I came up with just off the top of my head, not the top of my head, deep in the back of my head. But they,
based on research,
they had a really beautiful relationship in that these two guys that are coming towards the end of the line in their careers. George is 40, trying to be the champ, and he's big and overweight and very self-deprecating by this time. But he was even eating cheeseburgers at press conferences. And then Angelo's 73 and wondering when he should hang it up. So, and I just love that. To me, that could be a story in itself, is just these two old guys taking one more kick. And yeah, so that was a beautiful friendship as well. So not so much a mentorship, because by then George was such a seasoned boxer. He knew what he was doing.
Right. But friendship itself has its element of mentoring, because we help each other through hard times.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's share
true.
A goal.
And that's where Angelo, through all those years of wisdom, knew his role was not to teach George anything about boxing. It was to just give him whatever he needs.
I hate this, but I've come to the final question, which is, who are your mentors in life?
My first mentor is my mother. She passed away in 2003, but I think a true mentor is the one that, even when they're not there, you hear their voice loud and clear. And when she was alive and I was on the playground about to do something stupid, I would hear her voice. You have a tough decision. Is it A or B? And at the time, you think, this is a fork in the road in my life. Do I go to the left or the right or down the middle? You hear that mentor's voice, and I'd always hear my mother say, well, I think you should do this one, or, you know. And then after she passed away, it's still I hear her, and she's truly my mentor, and absolutely not only made me a better man, but a better husband, just a better all-around guy. And again, getting like Angelo, my family was very, I have two siblings. My father passed away. But because we came up in Canada, I don't know if I mentioned that. So when I went to my elementary school up there, that's kindergarten through grade 7, I was one of two black people in the school. And then we had one Chinese girl. And we'd nod at each other in the hall, hey. But Canada's a very friendly place, so there's racism, but it wasn't a real danger. But so having a strong family core, whereas before we went out those doors, you know, my parents would say, it's going to be different out there. And I'll never forget when they both said, I came home crying from school one day because someone had used the N-word or something like that. And I was crying about it, and my parents said, son, there are going to be people out there that don't like you just based on the color of your skin. And I said, but you taught me about fairness, and that's not fair. And then they said, you're also going to find that there's a lot of unfairness in life. And the only way you can do is hold your head up and, you know, treat people with respect and all the positive stuff. Then I got bullied by a kid. It's not bullied. It's just picked on. And this will put a bow on everything.
Right.
My older brother was 6 years older than me, still is. And we went down to the basement, and he said, let me show you what Muhammad Ali does. And he taught me how to jab. He taught me what a right hook was. He taught me how to box. And I, in no short order, became the strongest kid in the school. And then I realized I got drunk with the power, and I didn't like fighting because I just felt it went against my nature to beat people up. But I was, you know, learning how to stand your ground, and do you stand it with violence or do you just turn the other cheek like the Bible says? Like, there's all these messages. But my brother was a big influence because the person that teaches you how to defend yourself, whew, that just gives you so much confidence, you know?
That's very true. In essence, your family were your corner men.
We would watch Ali's fights, and then my brother would show me how to fight like Ali. And so when you apply what your superhero does, like, you can't apply what Spider-Man does or the Hulk does. But when it's 1976,
no, that's true.
And you see Muhammad Ali, who looks like you, is sitting on a stool after a fight and combing his hair with this exact same Afro pick that you have. I mean, come on, it doesn't get any better than that.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. I do almost hate to end this conversation, but we have a time limit and we have reached it. But it has been wonderful speaking to you today.
Delight. I can't thank you enough for this.
I look forward to more people reading the book and understanding this relationship, because to me, that's the core of Mentoris.
I absolutely love Mentoris. Sure. Thank you, Mentoris. And they're allowing me to write the book on Vince Lombardi right now. So...
Oh, I look forward to talking to you about that. Oh, this is wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for listening to the Mentoris Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.